You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to the fabulous Nick Mohammed. Nick is a performer who's not easy to categorize. He's almost like one of those sketch guys, except he's not often in a sketch show. He's definitely an actor. He's definitely a creator of stuff. He does character comedy, but all sorts of different types. But on top of that, he also is well known for pushing the envelope in ways you would not expect the envelope to be pushed. I'll let him tell you more about that. This is the fabulous Nick Mohammed. I cannot eat a banana. We started, by the way, just so you know.
Okay, that's all right.
I like a sort of a smooth way in it, that every so often my guest goes, oh God, we started.
Yeah, I changed my voice.
I cannot eat a banana without going, what is this? Because of you. You have done that magical thing, which is to add value to my life. And to sort of add
value to the fruit.
Add vocabulary, add words. Like, you've created things which live on in other people's lives.
Is that true?
Absolutely right. Okay. Absolutely right. Yeah. let's start off talking about Mr. Swallow and then maybe work backwards, because I've got loads of stuff to ask you.
Okay.
And the first question I want to ask you is, I know you've just finished the Soho run.
I have.
What is now called Dracula the Musical.
Yeah, just because Mr. Swallow the Musical, I think from an Edinburgh point of view, it was kind of fine because I sort of had like a bit of a following, or at least people who were kind of aware who Mr. Swallow was in Edinburgh, but in London, maybe not. And I think because it's quite a long run and we just needed to sell it out because it's an expensive show, that it was just like, everyone's heard of Dracula.
Yeah,
anyone who's heard of Dracula can come and see the show.
Yeah, it's an idiot doing Dracula.
Yeah, I have heard stories of people who didn't know that it was a kind of a character doing a version of Dracula, which is sort of people who genuinely thought they were
who came to see it.
A serious version of either Dracula or a serious version of Dracula the Musical.
Oh my God! And how did you?
They didn't like
heard of that after. They didn't like
they didn't
it.
Like it. I did hear about it afterwards from people who did really like it, but who'd said that their friends had come.
Yes.
And had really not liked it.
This man is mocking the great work.
They just thought it was a mistake.
Oh God,
That's all right. I don't think that was the majority of the audience. But,
no, sure,
but a small handful.
How was the run? Did you enjoy the run? Mm. Did it feel like a good fit doing it in London compared to Edinburgh? I suppose Edinburgh is very buzzy and festival.
Yeah, it was. It was 6 months after Edinburgh, so it was a good kind of enough time to kind of completely forget the music,
the songs,
the dancing, and all of that kind of stuff. But yeah, no, it felt good, and we were there for 4 weeks. And so, it was more shows than Edinburgh, actually.
Mm.
So it did feel, it was knackering, because I'd never done a run apart from Edinburgh. And the thing is with Edinburgh, you kind of go to Edinburgh and pretty much on the whole, you only have to really do your show and everyone's sort of there just to do their show. And that's kind of fine because everyone's just talking about their show. And it's just one thing you need to worry about. And you're kind of away from home. And so you're kind of, you can slightly, not that you relax necessarily in Edinburgh, but it's quite specific.
You can put off answering an email.
Because it's Edinburgh and you've got the excuse of Edinburgh and all that kind of jazz. And everyone's up there doing sort of the same thing. Whereas in London, everyone else is doing all their normal kind of industry job. But I was still doing kind of castings and writing and things like that. Mm. So, which is nice, obviously, to be doing that. And I was trying to do as much in the day, but then Then the show wasn't on until 9 o'clock as well, which is sort of later than I've usually gone on in the past, but which was quite fun in a way because it made the audiences quite a bit bawdier than normal.
I remember we were emailing to set this up, and I remember being not exactly aghast, but I kind of raised my eyebrows to go, oh, you sent me an email on the lines of, well, I've just got the show in the evening, so I'm spending all my days writing. And I was thinking, I'd have thought I'd be spending all my days lying on a couch.
The thing is, I set out trying to do so much. And it's the same with Edinburgh. I always think, Edinburgh in the day, once the show's running, I'll write a new script. And I never do. But, I mean, I did do quite a lot this time around. But it just meant, and, you know, just general kind of London living was just sort of kind of, you know, you kind of still do all the normal things that you would do if you're living in London. Whereas in Edinburgh, you don't. You make allowances for the fact that you've got the show. Whereas in London, it just sort of felt like, well, everyone else is sort of just getting on with it, so you've got to kind of get on with it as well. But it was really fun, like really fun.
It felt to me that Dracula the Musical, Mr. Swallow the Musical, was the best Mr. Swallow show so far. Did you feel that?
I think arguably, yeah, I think so. Because it's certainly the one that's attracted the most attention and the one that's played to the largest number of people. And so I suppose, but I mean, I think I feel that I had to do the kind of journey to get, I think if I'd have opened, if my Edinburgh debut had been Mr. Swallow Musical, I mean, I would have been very proud of it in many ways. But like, I think I had to get to that point with the character because, I mean, the last few Edinburghs have all been Mr. Swallow hours anyway. But then it was obviously a big leap to then go quite big and involve a cast, and you know, I never even properly even considered the idea of writing dialogue for Mr. Swallow, because when would that ever come about? Because it's very much a one-sided conversation with the audience, and you know, there might have been audience interaction in some of them, but obviously it's a world away from scripting dialogue and casting those people, and then also then putting it in the context of a all singing all dancing musical as well. So you could do, I suddenly realized that, well, actually I can have fun with this character in lots of different ways because there's so many different people to talk to, because I can be in character as, well, as Mr. Swallow, but then I can be in character as Dracula, and then even at some parts of the show I could be in character as Mr. Swallow, as Dracula, and then as him doing someone else as well, because he's taken on another part in the show, and then he can talk to, in all those different characters, the real audience, the kind of pretend audience, and the other cast, and you know, they're sometimes in character as their Dracula parts and sometimes not, because of the nature of the show, it sort of drops a fourth wall all the time. So it just, I just suddenly thought, oh, well, I can now really free myself up. Whereas before I've been, oh, well, it's like a COD lecture and I've got my PowerPoint and there's the audience. And I really enjoyed doing those shows. And I would, you know, there was something very rewarding about doing those solo shows. And they always had quite fiddly but big endings, like in a kind of, you know, magic-y kind of way. And I always liked that. I really liked that. And the musical sort of didn't really have that, but obviously it was different. It was big in a different way. And it did have some magic-y bits in it, I suppose.
I think you, a principle of the Mr. Swallow show is that you bite off more than you can chew.
As a
creator,
yeah,
and the character then has to
I know what you mean, you set yourself
some ludicrous Herculean task, like the, and I'm aware, I know it's a magic trick, but like the memory feat that you did at the end of one, because I've seen several of the hours, and you do something which is kind of seemingly noodling nonsense that doesn't go anywhere as this person flails around doing a fun thing with a variety of stuff and then it builds up to some sort of thing where people are going, oh, wow, he's actually done a thing. And what I loved about Dracula was that I knew you were doing Mr. Swallow the Musical. Yeah. And someone said, oh, it's a musical of Dracula. I was like, you know, is that going to be pre-recorded? I know you've done lots of video editing stuff, things like that. And when I got in there and saw a set of Dracula the Musical and went, oh, my God, he's actually going to do this. And then you actually do it.
Did you see it in Edinburgh?
Yes, I did. I saw it in Edinburgh, When you first come in with bat wings on roller skates.
Yeah.
Your cloaker area. The feeling in the room was this incredibly joyous atmosphere. You must have felt that on stage. People going, oh my God, he's actually going to do it.
It was quite nice. Weirdly, a lot of the previous shows, I'd always, the show was created with an end point in mind. As in, like, so I thought, okay, I want to be able to memorise a deck of cards, or at least look like I've got an amazing memory. So I want to do that. And then the other one is I want to look as if I can do mental arithmetic. And so whatever it takes, whether I learned that or whether I kind of used some theatricality to kind of achieve it. Like, I just thought, well, that's the end point. The end point's got to be this big sort of, in like, you know, the end of Derren Brown shows, always, and this, and this, yes, happened, and this, and, this, and you this, missed this,
and actually,
and this,
it was this, this, and actually, yeah, this.
I love all that. I love all that. And that had always been, okay, well, I'll kind of, so I'll roughly kind of create this lecture around that subject matter, but really it's just a platform for Mr. Swallow to talk nonsense for 45 minutes and then kind of end the show. But with Dracula, or Mr. Swallow the Musical, it was always, it was actually the start that was, it was always the first image. So the first image, the image of me entering as Mr. Swallow, dressed as Dracula on roller skates, and bearing in mind no one knew that it was about, it was even meant to be about Dracula.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
You were told. So yes, that was a deliberate, yes, point of not calling the show in Edinburgh Dracula the Musical. Because I really wanted to cling on to the notion that I want that image. I want people to get as excited as I find, because I find that so stupid. So stupid to be at the top of a staircase as well on roller skate. And you know, it's really, it's just stupid. I mean, it's just not, there's nothing clever about it. But like, and that for me was a start point. And the title, Mr. Swallow the Musical. So when the dot had said, well, if you're going back, just think big. And so I sort of thought kind of five or six ideas, which all had very silly but big titles, like Mr. Swallow the Musical.
Yes.
And so, and that for me, not necessarily for the audience, I had to then sort of write it, and then the Dracula idea kind of came second after that. But for me, the idea of, oh yeah, if he's putting on a musical, well, that'll be fun, right?
Yes.
Sort of like, well, that's the joke, isn't it? The joke is the title of the show,
yeah.
Mr. Swallow in a musical. That's silly.
So when you say that the dot told you to think big, is that Simon saying?
Yeah, so Simon, so yeah, so we met, and we met ages ago, like we met 2 years ago, maybe a bit longer, like to talk about the next kind of Swallow thing. And there was a few ideas. There was, I mean, some of them were, they, I kind of ended up sort of trying to plonk them all into Dracula. Like one was to do Dracula or do Jekyll and Hyde, kind of relatively, not straight, but just do the story and not have the fourth wall and not have the kind of, oh, and it's a rehearsal as well,
yeah.
Not have that kind of noises off-y kind of thing going on. And then one of them was, like Mr. Swallow Jurassic Park, like it was like a walking with dinosaurs, kind of with like an animatronic dinosaur. I can't remember some of the others, but they were just scaled up ideas. And I knew that I was going to be in the Queen Dome, so I was like, well, think. And then actually, it was just, oh well, Mr. Swallow the Musical, that's it. Because I think I also thought, oh, a horror show would be quite good, because I found the idea of Mr. Swallow being scared by something himself that he's created, I found that quite funny as an idea. And then it all kind of sort of became, and we were going to maybe do the story of Jesus, and then I sort of thought Book of Mormon and all that. I just sort of thought maybe. And so there, yeah, so Dracula just sort of then kind of became the thing, really, as to what it should be. And it took ages to write, because I wrote a really long script first, without any music. I knew where the songs were going to, but without lyrics.
Okay.
And I mean, that in itself, and I did a couple of read-throughs at the dot, was like an hour and 20 minutes. And so it just got sort of whittled down again and again and again, and then collaborated with a composer, Ollie Birch, who's brilliant, and a brilliant comic, and he knew the character very well.
Okay.
So
talking about the character then, the genesis of Mr. Swallow, because I wanted to, I will spend a bit of time on this, because I want to know how much of you is there in his madness. Let's stay with that for a moment, because obviously, like for me, I feel like I've probably, you know, we've worked together, I've done warm up on TV shows, you've been in a little bit, but I feel like when I look at you, I sort of see Mr. Swallow, because I have spent more time with him.
Mr. Swallow,
yeah.
It's probably a question for other people, isn't it? It's probably a question for my friends. I don't know. I think I like the idea. Like I often think a lot of, and I'm sure everyone has this, it's not like a me thing or even a comedian thing, is that people always think, oh, what's the worst thing that could happen now or be said now, or what be, you know, and if you just sort of see just something funny and situate, and then for me, the character of Miss Swallow is just vocalising that. And just sort of that.
So just explain that again, because that sounds fascinating.
So I think in anything, just sort of thinking what would be the worst thing, or the most inappropriate, or the silliest, or just the most sort of ridiculous sort of pernickety point to just suddenly ask or to explore at this point. And I sometimes, and I will think that in real life, I will think sometimes that if I, you know, if I'm at the supermarket and I see, I mean, I'm not thinking of anything funny.
Sure.
But if I'm in the supermarket and I see sausages or something, I, you know, and I'll just sort of think, oh, if I just sort of pushed everything down, like, I don't know. And then in my head, it's like Mrs. Wallow is the part of me that would do that. Like,
yes, okay.
And who would, or would, who would say something or would kind of goad someone, or not in a mean way, because he's not mean, because it comes from a good place, I think, ultimately. So I think there's a little bit of me, but it is based on a teacher. Like, it is based on someone real. And I mean, I've slightly exaggerated, obviously, their traits for, you know, to make it better, I suppose, to make it more interesting. But it is, it has elements of kind of what I sort of think would be the worst thing to do in a situation, which I do think as me, but just wouldn't dare say.
There is something really, I was thinking about what are the principles of Mr. Well. Swallow. It is childishness, yeah. But it's something, and I think that's within, there's something that is gloriously unrepressed about him.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I love when you would come on stage doing a handspring.
Oh, yeah.
Because why not do a handspring as you jump onto the stage?
Energy. I think there's no bad. And I quite like the idea of being that energetic. I mean, I'm not that energetic in my life. But I like, you know, I like the idea of, you know, being that in your face and not backing down. I think that's the thing. And I think earlier on, you know, I was so nervous just about doing character. I mean, character comedy is obviously kind of huge now. Even on the circuit, you know, there's lots of character comedy gigs. Mm. Well, I think, like, when we started out, like in like 2005, there weren't like that many kind of character sketch nights.
Yes.
And so I was sort of doing gigs in like stand-up nights and was thinking, geez, how is this going to kind of fare? And there were some places where stuff would do, like Gingrich and stuff like that, mm-hmm. you know, you'd kind of do better. But other times I was like petrified and I kind of almost wouldn't dare kind of prolong like a Mr. Swallow set for any longer than like necessary. I'd be looking for the quickest way to kind of get in and out of a character.
Okay.
Because of the nature of the environment, maybe. But then I think as my sort of confidence grew and maybe, well, definitely with doing more Edinburghs and things like that, part of the joke was almost that first Swallow Hour in 2010 it was, and Mr. Swallow had been in all the previous shows, was just like, how am I going to make people bear this for an hour?
Yes.
And that became part of the joke, was like, kind of, can you believe that I am going to be on stage
being this
speaking like
and
this
squeaking,
squeaking and shouting at you and like and going nuts for an hour? And I know other comedians who came to see that show in particular who had been, unfortunately, had been one round by the end, which I always felt was, that's the sign of a, like, you know, that's good. I'd rather start off than not liking and then win the round, rather than being on board at the, well, definitely the other way around. But even if they're on board at the start, I mean, because you have to really work for it then. It's quite nice to kind of think people are like, oh, okay, and then like it by the end. But I remember, like, I think it was Dan Tetzel texted Margaret, his wife, and I knew Margaret more than Dan at the time, and I think he texted us like, I just don't know if I'm going to be able to bear another like 55 minutes of this or something. But yeah, but I like it. I like that it tests people a bit. But I don't think it does now. I think people kind of accept it now, and it's become broader now. Like, it's become more just, or maybe I've just grown more comfortable with sort of just being very relaxed in that character.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting to try and follow how it's developed, because I feel like, having seen it sort of once a year, I think I've seen all the Mr. Swallow hours.
Yeah.
And it's quite hard for me. It's like growing up with someone. You sort of forget what they were like as a child a little bit, you know. So it's I'd be interested in just hearing a bit more about the changes that have occurred in him. I think something that the Guardian interview did touched on was the fact that he isn't... he's not defined. You can't really sum him up in a sentence. You can't say he's this sort of person. Like, his job, for example, is sort of, he's a kind of a lecturer. He does scenarios.
I mean, why is he now?
You know,
why is he now?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He started a musical.
But it doesn't matter, because he's so rich. So have any of those principles changed? Or what,
no,
what are
don't
the things that
so.
Have changed along the way?
I think because it is based on a truth, or at least something, as long as I know that it's based on a truth, I've always felt, okay, I can justify this character in my head and only hope that kind of comes across to an audience. But because it is, for me, it is grounded in this real person who just had this attitude problem.
Do they know, by the way? Have you ever...
No, she... I mean, and I should say, the reason why it's so camp is because it's based on a woman.
Okay.
And because there's no innuendo in the show. There never has been. Yeah. It's never been... sexy. Is that the word
maybe, but that's big for next year.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe you'll do a sex show. you know, for me, it's just because I'm playing a woman. So it's just, for me, it's an outrageous woman at that, but it's an androgynous kind of asexual kind of creation. But yeah, for me, she said, so she was a teacher. I mean, I don't know if she's passed away, but I don't know. But so maybe she, I don't think she knows at all because she left when I was still doing GCSE, but I'd been taught by her from like year seven, and I used to like impersonate her at school, and she used the lessons as just a platform to just spout outrageous views, nonsense. I mean, we did and she was always going on about like English language, and we're like maybe like preparing for our GCSEs, and she's like, right, we're going to do a debate, and it's like, well, that's not on the syllabus. Like, we're Merchant of Venice, and she's like, right, no debate, and we did debates like 7 or 8 weeks, and she was really into capital punishment.
Okay,
she really believed that people should be put to death for committing a crime, and like the first sort of. Our foray into like debating about capital punishment. Like, we sat down, she's like, right. And she just handed out these A3 massive pictures of Myra Hindley's face. And like, we were like 14, 15, and we're like, geez. And anyone who disagreed with her, you know, anyone who said, I don't know if it's going to solve the problem, really, kind of putting people to death, look at America, all these kind of like very sensible things to suggest. She was like, she lured them children to their death. I mean, it was really dark. I mean, she was ferocious. I mean, and like, she would, and you know, even then when we were doing Merchant of Venice, and I did a set that was about this specifically, this one lesson, where we were meant to be going through the play, and you know, allegedly she was going to allocate parts to everyone and we'd like read it as a group, and she was like, right, who wants to play Bassanio? I'll do that then. Who wants to play Solaria? I'll do that. And she didn't look up. She never would look up to see if anyone had volunteered, and she ended up reading the whole play, like all the parts in her own voice, all the way through.
With not changing the voices?
Not changing the voices. Time. Yeah, she would. I think she'd maybe say when she's like, Bassanio, in sooth I know not why I am sad. Solaria, why are you sad? Bassanio. And it was just, she was sort of formidable. But yeah, but I mean, that was obviously a starting point. And so for me, the attitude as if like, I mean, I feel that he kind of always acts as if he's just been heckled. He's always got this kind of like, this, what? Like, it's this kind of, this is incredulity. Like, I can't believe what you've just said to me.
Yes.
Kind of, even a really everyday, normal thing that someone says. Like, why are you asking me that? Like, what? He's found some really thing that's for him to be pedantic about. It's like everyone's having a go at him, but no
yes.
one is.
Yes.
He's having a go at everyone
else. Hence the frustration with everyday things such as bananas, or like the concept of infinity.
Oh, yeah.
It pisses me off.
Like, I mean, you just don't get anything. And it's that famous kind of thing of that, you know, that hopefully, you know, if I got a TV show, Miss Swallow, like, hopefully it would just fall into that thing of, it's the character who wants to be in control or wants to be in a position of responsibility, which that's always been a running theme, in that he's always been in a position of somewhat more powerful or authoritarian. But he's just rubbish at it. He's just so bad at it. And that's just the... That is the base joke, is that he wants this kind of power and draw, but he's rubbish.
So this is Nick. He's just so much fun to talk to. Amazing to watch. Really, I don't know if I completely got across in this episode just how knocked out I am. If you want to see the sort of stuff he does, and I think this is a good example, because it is by no means his slickest or most tailored work. He's done some brilliant, you know, kind of mime accents and music in the past with real sort of finesse and precision. But quite separate to that, have a look for Nick Mohammed Jurassic Park on YouTube, in which he sings his version of the words to the Jurassic Park theme tune. I believe he's in character at the time as Mr. Swallow. And it's a sort of a no budget filmed on his phone sort of affair, but it just makes me cry with laughter. You can follow Nick on @NickMohammed on Twitter, and he doesn't appear to have a website, but keep an eye on what he's up to on YouTube. There's loads of fun things to see there, and do follow me on Twitter. His Twitter feed is very funny. Couple of quick things. This is an email from a listener, which I felt I had to read you. I'm very proud of this. He's Ian Seaburn. Says, Stuart, I just wanted to say a massive thank you. Please accept this donation of the entire fee for my second ever paid gig. Ian, thanks so much, man. He says, my first fee went on beer and a celebratory late night service station pasty. you'll regret that. I mean, if ever there was a comedian that managed not to buy any pasties, I'd like to meet them. He says, but I promised myself I'd donate as soon as the paid booking started coming in. Inspired by the podcast, I started gigging 18 months ago. I've racked up around 150 gigs around the country and made some great friends. The insight and advice I've gleaned from the podcast has been invaluable. I've listened to every episode, most more than once, saw a couple of the live records in Edinburgh, also saw your solo show, which my wife and I loved. Looking forward to your new show this year. Thanks again, you absolute legend. Ian, I think you're an absolute legend. You are one of my... I mean, I know I've been keeping a private running tally of people who've emailed me and said that they started, at least in part, because of this show. I know there's lots of newer acts listening to this and more experienced acts as well. I know people find it inspiring in a way that I am hugely proud of. And thank you if you're one of those people. And and also, you're welcome. It makes me very happy to do this show, as you know. But I do have a small running tally of people who I think were sort of started at zero and then they heard the podcast and went, I'm going to bloody do it. And if you are one of them, then feel free to email me as well. Let me know how you're getting on. I'm in touch with some of you, I know. But thank you so much to Ian. I really appreciate that. You too, whoever you are, whether you're an actor or not, you can donate to the podcast. Go to comedianscomedian.com and click on the donate button. The donate button on my exciting new website, currently being put together for me by kind of technical polymath, James Hingley. He's working on a new website for me, which is going to have all sorts of engaging features. So I look forward to launching that soon. The donate button, I promise, will be nice and big for those of you that struggle finding it. If you'd like to do a regular payment, please don't tick the regular payment box. I'm having a very kind listener look through that at the moment. He suspects he might know why it's going wrong, and he's having a little tester of that. So thanks to him. If you would like to make a recurring payment, you can do that via patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Patreon.com, which is a system like, there was one a few years ago called Flatter, where you could basically, you sign up to the system and then anything you like that's subscribed to Patreon, you can just, with one click, you can add a small monthly donation. So feel free to do that, or you can give us a one-off donation of 20 quid, a pound a show, or whatever you think is 10% higher than reasonable. And thank you to everyone that's done that. And a final plug now with this one for the Nina Conti podcast coming up at Soho Theatre on the 5th of May at 9:30 p.m. If you go to sohotheatre.com or click on the link at comedianscomedian.com, remember to enter the discount code FAFF, F-A-F-F. Possibly it has to be in capitals, but give it a try either way. You can get 25% off tickets. I have just been watching Nina Conti's documentary about Ken Campbell. What's it called? It's got a great title and I've put it down somewhere in my flat and I can't find it. Search for the Nina Conti Ken Campbell documentary, all about how she became a ventriloquist and her search to say goodbye to her mentor and former lover, Ken Campbell, who was one of the most outrageously invigorating theatrical and comic voices that we've ever had. So do some research there by way of homework prior to the Nina Conti episode. The documentary just blew me away, and it perfectly uses her husband, comedian Stan Stanley, and sort of bookending it in a way that I thought was really sweet. Can't wait to talk to her more about that, and also a particular scene in which one of her puppets is sort of really against her. I think she's a bit drunk and she's trying to find the voice of this puppet that ends up being a very negative, self-loathing kind of a voice. It's basically absolutely right for the Comedian's Comedian podcast. So come and see her at Soho Theatre on the 5th of May. I'm off to Tallinn next week and then the Secret Welsh Festival after that. Tallinn, I'll be interviewing Mitch Benn, brilliant comedian, musical guy you'll know from The Now Show and from Radio 4. And Mark Watson will be my guest at the Secret Welsh Festival. And then The Midnight Beast, I've just been listening to their albums as well in the car in preparation of my interview with them, that is coming up soon. That's all of the bluster for now. Let's get back to the wonderful Nick Mohammed.
It seems to me that you're that you have happened upon several kind of tenets of clowning, like having problems with objects, having problems with things. Yeah. You know what I mean? That there's did you ever are these all things you've stumbled on yourself?
I think so, because I never really, I mean, I did magic as a kid, and for a while, you know, professionally up until quite, well, relatively recently, to be honest. But
Were you a gigging magician?
Yeah. All
what was your best trick as a gigging magician?
Oh, God knows.
What was your closer?
Cards, I suppose. It was always cards. Well, I did, like, you know, the kind of card memory stuff kind of came a little bit through that. You know, I did sort of kind of cardy mentalism-y kind of things.
Okay.
Yeah, mainly kind of close-ups. So I did a lot of kind of like weddings and hotels and that kind of thing. And I can't, to be honest, I sort of stopped because I just sort of didn't really... I don't think I was very good at it. I mean, I think I was fine at it. But there's a thing with magicians, and I count myself as one of these people who kind of thought this certainly at the time, is that you kind of approach it with, oh, if your tricks worked, then your sort of job is done.
I don't think
that is... I think now, having sort of acted a bit more and properly gigged in a live environment doing comedy and stuff, is that it's not... That's not... You can't just do that, because you're sort of 60% of the way, really. And actually, if that... I mean, presentation is... everything. So I gigged a lot, so I kind of knew... I knew, like, some elements of kind of performing, but it wasn't that funny. And I never went to, you know, drama school or studied drama or anything like that.
Mm.
So I think I have slightly stumbled across them just from dicking around, I think. And watching loads of stuff that I then find funny and that I think, oh, I want to do that or do my version of that, I suppose.
Yes. Before we get into writing the stuff, just a sort of final question about Dracula, really, which I was thinking about opening with, but I didn't want to broadside you.
Yeah.
I look back at comedy.co.uk, which aggregates all the reviews, and you got 4s across the board.
Yes.
And you didn't get a 5.
No.
Like,
I don't think I ever have.
A, how is that possible, given how incredibly good that show was? And B, did you reflect on it? Did that form? Is that in your sphere of consciousness?
It's not. I mean, it's not. The thing is, I'm very, very... Because I used to do all my own... I had a really horrid experience with the PR, who I won't mention just for professional sake. But, like, I thought she was dreadful. And for me, she epitomised that kind of... the type of person that you sometimes get in Edinburgh, who sort of feeds off people who are trying to do something creatively interesting, and there's maybe a good handful of people who are there just to kind of feed off that and make a lot of noise and charge you lots of money and not really do a job. Is that fair to say that? I think it's fair. It's hardly saying something new, is it? So since then, which is back in 2000 whenever, I then did my press. So I always had a very kind of good relationship because I just used to contact them myself.
Yes.
And only really when I started going with the Dot did they obviously then kind of handle it. So I kind of had a good relationship, and I sort of figured, well, if I'm doing this, I sort of figured also that no one knows my show kind of better than me. And I hope that people like it. And if they don't, I'll kind of think, well, there might be something fair in what they say. But I would just read everything. I kind of just didn't mind. And, you know, fortunately, like, touch wood, press is on the whole, something like the last few years, has been good or kind of getting better. And I just sort of think, well, that's fine. That's kind of all right. And if I got a bad review, I just think, well, it's fine. You'd think about it and then you'd do your next gig. And if that had gone well, you'd forget about it. I always would want to know. I mean, I was never actually the Dot of really good about not telling you when press are in, because they would never want me to know. But I never minded. And you come to recognise these people and what they look like because you have correspondence with them and they're on panels for this, that and the other. And so you end up knowing all this stuff anyway. And I just don't mind. And I sort of figure, well, I put loads of work into a show. I kind of want to know what people think. And there are a lot of brilliant reviewers who work really hard, who've reviewed me loads in the past, and I want to know what they think of the next Swallow thing.
Do you consider them in terms of thinking, I want to surprise my audience, I want to be better than I was last year? Do you think, definitely. I really want to bring something that definitely. Journalist X has never seen before?
Definitely audiences. I don't necessarily work... And I think, as a byproduct of that, I would definitely think, oh, and so I hope the kind of critics will pick up on that, or people who've seen me before, industry people or whatever. But always aim to surprise. Always have set out to kind of... not even if it's not, say, raising the bar, but changing the bar, just completely changing. And that helps that Mr. Swallow is so vague in terms of what he does or what he's meant to do, because I can just change it every time. And I think I used to worry about, does that matter? Does it matter that he's not got a consistent backstory? I mean, he does have a slightly consistent backstory, but not like a... you know, not in a way of, say,
he's got a far more consistent flavor than
I think tone-wise it's consistent, but I think, you know, the whole format of a show change, you know, can change, and that's nice. But yeah, I've always engaged with press and think that you gotta, it just comes with the job, and I just don't, I don't really have opinions on people who don't. I mean, I know a lot of people who don't like knowing when press are in or what press say, and I just sort of think, well, I just figure if I've invested a year and a half in making something as good as I think it can be, then I kind of want to know if I've really misjudged it, I suppose. And on the whole, but and then the five-star thing, definitely I don't worry about that. Definitely. I mean, I would, obviously, you kind of, in an ideal world, you think, oh, yeah, five would get the extra kind of whatever on the publicity, or you'd kind of sell X many more tickets. Maybe, would you? I don't know. It also has, you know, I've talked to other comics who said sometimes, you know, you get five stars. And we sort of even saw it with this show, in that you get a really good review in a particular paper, and then your audience the next few days just changes completely.
Because they're
because they're there because they've read a good review. They? And they're there to be like, yeah, they're there to kind of, well, I'm sure they're there to enjoy themselves, but they're there, they haven't necessarily, they've just come for slightly different reasons, I think. And they want to be impressed in maybe different ways, or they're looking for certain different, maybe different things. And I don't know, it just changes things a little bit. And I think having a 5-star review or a 4-star review, maybe that effect is exaggerated. Mm. I wouldn't know, because I've not got 5. but I honestly have never, ever worried about that.
When you come to write the show, have you got ideas for the next Mr. Swallow show?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not happening until 2016.
But okay. Yeah. But when you come to write that, will you be sitting down at a desk and writing it? Will you be scribbling notes and
taking
on stage?
Well, I'm already scribbling notes now.
Yes, not this, right is, now. This is what you've been writing.
Yeah, I mean, you are.
That's what I've been doing.
So I've already started. So I actually started making notes in September after it, because I always feel that that's always a good point to just splurge a load of, and they're just one sentence, you know, they're sentence ideas, because you get, I don't know about you, I mean, I try and see as much stuff as I can. I don't usually see that tons, but I try and really seek out the stuff that I know that I'm probably going to really like, or I've heard that this is really creatively interesting, or and I always feel that that kind of stuff is useful for kind of thinking, oh yeah, ooh, what if I did this? What if, not to take someone's idea, but to kind of, you get an enjoyment out of seeing something new.
Yes.
Or some, a new idea, and that kind of get, and after Edinburgh, especially when you've been doing the same show again and again and again, you kind of crave something.
It's worth hanging on to that post Edinburgh momentum. Just seen all the stuff.
Yeah, and you've got a taste for trying, you know, especially taking a character that's maybe done well, and then thinking, oh, well, maybe I could. So I do have an idea. I can just say what it is. I mean, it's Santa Swallow. It's Mr. Swallow is Santa Claus. So okay. It's kind of a mashup of a kind of Mr. Swallow is Santa, Mr. Goldorf is the elf. And kind of a Christmas carol. It's kind of got elements of Grove's Christmas Past and all that, and the Nativity, sort of all into one.
Okay.
So that's the premise of the show. But there's no kind of... So it's an out-and-out musical as well. It's a Christmas musical, which ideally do in Edinburgh, summer 2016. Just go summer, it doesn't matter, because it's Edinburgh. But, and then do Christmas 2016.
So
in a big theatre in London, ideally. Okay. So a big kind of Christmassy, panto-y studio.
Now, I'm so cynical that one of the first thoughts I had there was, that's smart, Christmas money spinner, if you've got a Christmas-themed show.
Well, no, but for me, well, again, I've got a long list of different ideas, and at the moment, it's just that's the one that's kind of coming out top, and it might change,
okay.
But at the moment, it feels like...
Like,
and weirdly, I had to chat when I first thought, and it was back in September. I like phoned Tim Key immediately because obviously he's doing Slutcracker.
Oh yes, yes,
it's not Slutcracker, Jesus, he's doing Slutmas.
Yes,
or which he's done a couple of shows, and I just wanted to check that we weren't treading on any similar territory. And he was like, "Oh, geez," and he was basically saying that he can't have dibs on Christmas, which is fair enough, I suppose.
But that sounds like a Christmas single.
Yeah, exactly. Can't have dibs on Christmas. And also, I'm sure that Tim's approach to Christmas and Mr. Swallows are very, very,
yes, absolutely,
in terms of everything, really.
So you're starting scribbling notes already.
So I'm writing, and that takes the form of scene ideas, song ideas. I've even written bits of dialogue. Already told the dot and director and the composer, you know, about it. So you know, probably keep the same kind of core feel about it. I mean, I just sort of figure I want, you know, having written a musical, and I'd never done that before, I really enjoyed it. And Dracula was really good. But now I definitely think, oh, there's a weakness, there's a weak spot there, or there's a bit there.
I would fine-tune,
or I would do better. And this idea allows me to do that. So I kind of definitely think
that. I was going to ask something I like to ask my guests is, if we talked about reviews and your confidence in yourself means that you don't need to be beholden to them. If you were to review yourself, If you were to review Dracula the Musical now...
I would give it 4 stars.
I would. Because I spent, like, because every... So, I mean, it's hardly me either. I mean, it was an ensemble. Like, you know, there was a 5-piece band who were incredible. It's an amazing director. There's an amazing cast. There's an amazing, like, designer, lighting designer, director, composer. I mean...
If you were to review your process and your involvement in it, if you were to go, okay, how could I... What were there things that you thought... There was a weak spot there. There was a weak spot in the process. Were there things that you thought, this isn't my greatest strength. I've got to work on that next time.
I would probably have put more Dracula story in it. Because I think I sort of... Because my natural instinct, certainly as thinking of Swallow, was to undermine, like, always undermine. That's his thing. He'll undermine. So you know, Dracula's on roller skates and he's like, he can't sing his song properly, or he's worried about this. You know, it's always to kind of take the premise and undermine it. Whereas actually, I think you, and I think we got there, but maybe we could have just gone a 1 star further, was I suppose to examine a bit of the story and do it for real. But it's still comically, but not undermine as much and come up with a kind of, maybe another ensemble number kind of would have helped that. And, you know, we even considered it. There was talk of potentially taking the show to a different theatre, and that maybe we would have to do 2 acts, maybe. And, like, would I consider doing, an hour, sort of 20-minute show and doing it? And you know, maybe I might even do that for the Christmas one, because that, for me, opens up things as if you're playing with 2 halves, what can happen in the interval, what could have happened at that point. So there are just different things that I think, I'm thinking, you could do that, and then you could do that, and you know, trying to pack all that, trying to do the story of Dracula and everything else in 55 minutes is tough. And I think that we could have, or I could have maybe afforded with the writing to have just embraced Dracula a little bit more, because there was a lot of undermining in it. You know, there was a lot of kind of stuff that wasn't Dracula. There's probably 20 minutes.
You seem to have a really good instinct for comic opportunity. I think you've got a really good instinct for where things can go wrong, and you know, you're kind of like, and it does. Regular listeners to the show will be annoyed with me constantly mentioning clowning, but it reminds me of a clowning exercise I did with a teacher called Fraser Hooper, brilliant performer, where he would say, okay, you 5 people get together and you've got 2 minutes, put together Little Red Riding Hood.
And then
they'd show it and it would be completely unready and frantic and go, right, everything that went wrong, now you've got 10 minutes to make all of those problems worse. And that seems like you're kind of absolutely instinctively going...
I suppose that is a little bit of that. I suppose it comes with, like, thinking of, well, what's the worst thing to kind of happen now? And, like, in my, like, early script drafts, you know, before there was a budget in place, it's like things like the set falls on top of someone, or there's an explosion at the wrong point, or, you know, it was always kind of taking, okay, so this song falls apart, but then how does that song fall apart? Is it because he's on roller skates and he can't actually skate, or he doesn't know where to stand, or he's not on his spotlight, or the pyrotechnic's gone off at the wrong point, so something's broken that is meant to be used in the next scene. You know, it's kind of... And then thinking of that cumulatively, I suppose, which is maybe what you're saying, is that then how does that impact on things that then happen later? Like, I love that. I think it's just farcical, isn't it? It's when, you know, there is, you know, something goes wrong, and then because of that, something goes wrong again, and then it just builds and builds, and so it's just all getting worse and worse and worse. I love that as a thing. I would laugh at that. That's what makes me laugh.
What decisions did you make? Can you give us an example of something that you cut from the show, or a joke that didn't work, or a moment that wasn't strong enough in the
end? I suppose there was a whole... Jesus, tons. So much to make the show.
Give us 100 examples. Yeah.
Just list the top 500. There was a bit where I got an audio... In a really early draft, there was this conceit that there is another actor in it whose train's delayed, so he's not here. And we keep on trying to manage between us with that person doing their part, but then there's one scene where they absolutely have to be there, and I kind of get an audience member out and kind of do like an acting lesson with them to train them up to sort of do this bit, and then the kind of then joke is actually all they have to just say is no at the end of the scene, and that was it. And it was just a thing. I think it was one of those things where I thought, okay, so I'm going to do it. So what are the things that I could do in this show? And it was one of the like list of things that I could do. And so I wrote it up and sort of trialed it kind of like in the read throughs and stuff. And I think it might have even done it in a few of the early rehearsals, but it just went because it didn't really... It would have been fine. It would have worked, I think, and it's audience participation. On the whole, that kind of works with Mr. Swallow. You know, it's a different relationship to some of the others mm-hmm. that's going on. So it would have added in a weird way, but, like, from a, how efficient is it in terms of laughs and story and, you know, suddenly your 55 minutes just goes... And, you know, because we had 70 songs in the show as well, so... You know, that was already eating 20 minutes into the show.
I think in something like 114 episodes, I think, and I may be wrong, I think you're the only person I've spoken to who's used the word efficient in relation, and I don't mean it in a negative way at all,
it's quite clinical, isn't it?
Well, I think it is typical of your approach, because there's a certain does it make the boat go faster kind of feel to what you're describing. You've got this mammoth task, and rather than, I mean, I know I don't do this anymore, but I'm sure with some of my shows, part of the instinct in part of the year has been, Christ, I've got to fill an hour. And I suppose if you're at a stage now where you're able to write with such confidence.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
It's about what can work. And
it's also because I now take 2 years to write a show. Whereas before, when you're starting out, you've got to go every year, or you're at least kind of encouraged to go every year, and there's that kind of etiquette. It's trickier. Well, it's just, you know, there is that element of, like, sugar, I've got to find an hour's worth of material, and, you know, you're kind of maybe cobbling together a little bit more. But I think, now, just because maybe the ideas are a bit bigger or the conceits are, you know, they're always quite broad, so there's always a lot of areas that I could have kind of could go into. And because Mr. Swallow is easily distracted as well, you know, he can sort of talk about anything, even within the conceit of a particular subject matter or something like that. So I think there's always part of me, certainly since maybe because Stefan Goloszewski, who writes Him and Her and is brilliant and used to be in Cowards and all that, he directed the Edinburgh shows from 2007, not the most recent one. But he really kind of taught me to, I think, be very efficient. And, like, he's so efficient. I mean, he would go through a script at Edinburgh and would make changes until the last day. And to be fair, I don't do it, but even on, you know, the last week of the musical, I was sending around, not notes, but I was kind of making little tweaks here and there, just to certain things, because I sort of think, you know, it's just a constant fine-tuning process. I mean, anyone who edits there, even if you're doing very broad brushstrokes, anyone who thinks that, oh, that joke don't work, or so I might lose it or improve it, or, you know, that's just being efficient, really. But, I mean, going into detail, I suppose, I mean, ultimately, I think in Edinburgh especially, maybe London as well, like, value for money is so important. Like, I mean, our ticket prices in London were 20 quid at a weekend, and I was like, that's a lot, you know, that's a lot for an hour. And, you know, that was the theatre's ticket price. You could see a stand-up for that price as well. You know, it's not... But then for me, I was like, well, you know, would I sort of fear, would I kind of get my value for money? And it wasn't that much in Edinburgh. But I just think that there's so many comics to choose from now, which is a great thing in lots of respects. There's so much competition and good competition in Edinburgh and the like. I just sort of think you gotta deliver and do something. Or at least I feel that I want an audience to be kind of like, I've just sat there for an hour and that was exciting. Like, I felt excited and I felt that I did get value for money. Because I've definitely sat in shows where I've sort of thought, well, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. But, like, is it really, like, I don't know. I just get excited when I see, and it's often not always comedy, but, well, when you see a good comedy show, you're just like, geez, I mean, that's just stonking. But if I see, like, Darren Brown's show or even, like, Phantom of the Opera, I mean, I know obviously it's a very different kind of show, or Torval and Dean perform, you just think there's such a kind of, there's so much thought gone in, and they just, you know, it's just a thing of really, like, deliver, like, promise the premise, like, really deliver on what you are claiming to do.
Did you say promise the premise?
I think so.
Is that a phrase?
I think a producer might have said it to me one time. Oh, God. I mean, you told me not to, but I do. I'm worried and I sound pretentious now. But it is just that thing of, like, kind of really wanting to give as much. You've got an hour to really showcase what you've been working on in a year, 2 years, you know. Yeah. I just sort of think you've got to, like, it's got to be top-notch. And, of course, you're going to have days where you kind of, maybe your performance level is not up, or you kind of, you might make a mistake, or you fluff a line, or, you know, you sort of think a certain section needs tweaking, but that's fine, because that's all part of it. But I just think you've got to, you know, the default performance and show has got to be up there, because otherwise no one's going to pay attention, I just think. I think that's true. I don't know.
I think you're, from what little I know of your background, and I know you're...
very violent.
and I know uniquely, I think I've heard along the way, you got into Cambridge and turned it down in favour of Durham.
Oxford.
Is that right? Oxford.
Yeah, Oxford. Okay. And then did PhD, or started doing PhD at Cambridge, which I then left to do
really? Comedy. Well, I mean, really, both hands, two fingers to Oxford, isn't it? But you're... you are the other way. You're frequently described, and I know you write your press releases. So maybe this is a web of lies. I'm always interested in the way people seed information about themselves. But you were studying. You're a trained geophysicist, and you play the violin. And you were a magician, and you're what people call a polymath. Which I think.
Yeah, I didn't write that press release, but
but you can do all kinds of crazy stuff. Like, you're a very intelligent guy. You probably, like, if I found out you could speak five languages, I wouldn't bat an eyelid.
I can't speak any of our English. honest.
But I wondered whether, well, it's in two parts really. Do you, like, amongst comics, you're a polymath. Amongst geophysicists, are you a sort of layabout? Like, do you, is there any thought in your head along the lines of, well, comedy's sort of a bit of a DOS, really, in terms of the use of my talents.
Do I think that?
In terms of your use of your intelligence, like, you're obviously an incredibly smart guy.
I don't think I'm that smart. Like, I kind of, you know, I didn't get.
I'll ask some of my other geophysician. Okay,
well, yeah. I think there are a lot of clever people out there doing lots of clever jobs. And, you know, you can be a clever comedian. I'm not saying I'm a clever comedian, but, you know, you can be a clever comedian. And I don't know. I think that, like, my friends who've, like, sort of stuck with me throughout, I think that they would just say, oh, it's just me just sort of doing my thing, but in a just different subject area. I think, because I sort of, you know, I approached geophysics kind of quite, okay, right, come on, let's get this done. Then. Let's do it. You know, I was on, you know, my PhD, or, you know, what I started, it was all based, you know, it was all in the Faroe Islands. And so, you know, I had to go there for, like, months at a time and just dig holes. I mean, so I just had to approach that in a way of, like, all right, this is going to be hard work. Come on, let's sort of get to it. And I like that in a way. I like sort of the challenge of it. But, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, doing comedy is so much more of a DOS than digging holes. But it comes obviously with its own sort of fears and challenges and all that kind of thing. I think that there was maybe an element, like, my mum and dad were kind of a little bit like, oh, so you're going to leave a PhD in Cambridge to do comedy. So how's that going to work out? I kind of did, I suppose, just have this sort of blind optimism, which Touchwood is sort of working out at the moment. But, you know, maybe it could all change. I don't know.
What when you? Yeah, I don't know how many of these shows you've heard, but you'll the people at home will be going. Yeah. He's mentioned Fears. Stu's going in.
Oh, jeez.
What kind of things are you struggling with as someone who is talented, skilled, successful? You've got relationships with the press. You've gone up and smashed Edinburgh. You've got loads of other exciting work going on at the moment, which we'll talk about in a moment. And you seem happy. You know what I mean? You're a happily married guy with his fabulous wedding ring on.
Smashing my ring.
Yeah, lovely. What kinds of challenges are you presented with? Do you have kind of... do you notice any particular sorts of anxieties cropping up? Are there one of the weak spots? If I was trying to kill you, where would I go
first?
Well,
definitely when I've got something that I know is going to be showcased. So really the only kind of real example, tangible example, is things like Edinburgh. So for example, if I do another Mr. Swallow musical, I think, touch wood, a lot of people will come and want to see a show as good as Dracula. And why not? I would, if I'd seen something that was really good and then went to their second show, I'd want to be more impressed, if not as pleased with my first experience. So not delivering has always scared me. The idea of going up to Edinburgh, like, successively and tailing off or genuinely just not delivering at all and going downhill, I would hate that. I'd hate to think that I'd wasted a long time and people are like, yeah, they're sort of past it now, or they've just, it was better back then. I don't like that. That scares me.
What would that mean to you? Why does that scare you?
Well, I just suppose it would make me think that I've just not done my job. It would just make me think that I'm not doing well at my job. Because even if, and I don't even mean doing well in terms of like getting TV work, or I mean sort of doing well from a financial point of view, but I just mean kind of creatively sort of doing well, like creatively coming up with something that I'm really proud of and that I've got enough of a thing, whether it's kind of my peers saying that they enjoy it or it doing well in, say, Edinburgh or critically or something like that, or my genuine fulfillment of doing a show and seeing it from kind of an idea to completion and doing a long run somewhere or something like that. Like that, I find deeply, deeply fulfilling from a life point of view. And I think that what I meant by digging holes in the Faroe Islands is that if that was my job, you know, that you know, I'd get fulfillment of completing a task. I think, you know, not being able to kind of like sort of deliver in terms of what I've kind of set out to do, I'd find that just a bit disappointing. I think I'd just be a bit disappointed. And because of the nature of this work, if it's a show, then everyone sees that disappointment. You can't hide. And if it's your baby, if it's your character, your premise, your script, you're the main part in it, then you can't really blame anyone. You can't blame anyone else. And so I think I'd just be disappointed, I think. And I suppose I fear that feeling of like thinking, that was a bit of a sorry month, wasn't it? And I've had that maybe earlier on, like a little bit. I mean, like, touch wood, I've always then felt the desire to keep going. So there's always been enough of a good thing of it to make me think, no, this is going in the right direction. Keep going, sort of trust your instincts. But if I realised my instincts were wrong, I suppose that's what I'm saying. If I realised I just sort of messed it all up, I think that I would worry about that.
Just an observation. You, four times in the last half an hour, you've said touch wood and physically touched the table in front of you, which to me, were I a sort of, you know, deductive type of person, I would suggest that, like, you feel like you don't want the balloon to burst somehow.
I just feel very lucky. I feel like genuinely quite, you know, things, I love it. Like, I love it so much. Like, I adore it. And I am, because I never set out to be a comedian at all. And until recently, you know, well, relatively recently, but like doing the Cambridge postgrad thing and like, you know, I was definitely going in such a different direction. And it would have been fine, I'm sure it would have. And I worked at Morgan Stanley after that for a bit. And that would have been fine. And I made some good friends from that. But ultimately, you know, I knew, and I was desperately like thinking, be really good if I could just not be that, and I could just be a working comedian who was pleased, and I could earn a living from that. That, and you know, in a way, I know how close it could be to, like, it'd be like, nah, sorry, your script's not getting picked up, and no, you didn't get that casting, and yeah, you can do your Edinburgh show, but have you run out of ideas? Is this the end? You know, I'm not that pessimistic as a person generally, and I don't think that about my career at the moment, or even a few years ago. You know, I've always hoped that it's going in the right direction. But, you know, you see it all around you. And even with comedian friends, when things don't work out, and or even friends who aren't working in comedy, but maybe doing something creative, and it's their dream and it's their absolute passion. And it just can't, they just can't sustain it. You know, they can't. You know, it's just even financially it's not tenable, or practically, you know, with a family or whatever, you know, those things just don't work out. And, you know, I would, you know, I do count myself very, very lucky at the moment that I'm managing to make a kind of a living out of it and enjoying it. And you know, it kind of feeds back into itself, because then that, you know, buys me time to write something new, you know, that I can then creatively then feel fulfilled. So it's kind of, I do feel that is a kind of a positive feedback thing. And I would hate, you know, I would be scared if that kind of just got so disrupted that I couldn't do that. I would feel a bit, I'd be disappointed.
Do you have any particular strategies for dealing with when the writing is difficult or when the work is difficult? You know, there's things like people say, you know, don't get it right, get it written. You know, it's kind of like ways of mentoring yourself almost to get yourself over times of block or times of frustration.
I was going to touch wood again, but I just won't because I'm not that superstitious. But I don't get writer's block as such. Like, I just kind of keep at it. Like, I'll just, even if it's a bit like nonsense and it'll never really make the page or the sort of stage or TV or anything, I just sort of think, I'll just write it. And I don't, like, you know, fortunately there haven't been kind of lengthy periods where I've really just felt I don't really have an idea that I want to kind of do, or there's not something I want to explore with this kind of character or idea or something. So I kind of, I've always been able to kind of come up with goods. I mean, and then it's obviously maybe arguably the most important part of the craft is then actually then fine-tuning that and taking what you've done, whether it's the ideas or the jokes, and making them better and testing them out and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, but the kind of the front line side, that kind of just sitting at your computer and just sort of... I mean, I write cold a lot of the time, you know, I won't even know what I'm going to write.
Is that what you mean by writing cold? You'll just start
I'll
writing
just start. So I'll have like... So it'll just be like a one sentence, like... So I think I had one sentence thing was just like Miss Swallow doing ice bucket challenge. I think it was just at the time of when that was current. Mm. So I won't be doing it.
Yeah, you may have missed the boat.
but I never performed it. I did write like two sides about him talking about it. Just because I sort of thought, well, I kind of want to write that. And I just sort of felt, oh, I'll just sort of see. And I didn't know what any of the jokes were going to be before I'd written it. I just sort of thought, well, there's the character and the idea of something, a subject matter, and just sort of see what happens, really. And that's kind of true for the Edinburgh shows in a lot of respects. I mean, Dracula was a little different because I knew I had to sort of tell the story of Dracula and kind of do the kind of the noises off you kind of thing in terms of their relationships, that they have to sort of start off and then kind of fall out and then it all gets back together at the end. So from a structure point of view, it was a lot easier to kind of put things kind of step by step into a sort of certain sense of order. And I've definitely struggled in the past with structure in some of the shows. That's been always the biggest task, because I could write loads of material, but how I kind of make it work sort of structurally, that's always, I found that tricky in the past.
I'm glad you have some problems. Write loads of material.
But also the big qualified statement is that tons of it's not good, and yes, doesn't even make the, you know, but I can write, but you know, but whether it's good or whether it's appropriate or, you know, it's gonna lead to anything, I don't know.
But I think what I feel like I'm discovering about your attitude to it is that doesn't matter to you. You don't write something that then isn't going to be used and go, oh God, I'm not doing it. You know what I mean? Like you seem, I suppose maybe you have very positive self-talk. Like you're not criticising the work as you make it. You're just happy to churn it out and worry about it.
Yeah, at a certain stage. I mean, like, I think there has to come a point where you then think, okay, I've got this stuff and I need to kind of fine tune it, because otherwise it just sort of becomes a bit of a sort of sprawling, you know, because then there's a danger, I suppose, if you were being efficient, you kind of think, oh well, you know, where is this leading? Like, it's got to like kind of lead to something, and so you might think, oh well, at this stage. But even like this morning, I'm doing research for a thing I'm doing at the moment, and I dug out notes on a subject matter from 2011, and it took me ages to find them. Actually, it was like the biggest waste of time ever to try and find them, but I found them, and there's like a few sentences in there that I think have sparked things, and I find that useful, you know. So even if it's something that I think, well, it's something, it's a bit of dialogue, or it's an idea for a character, or it's a character talking about a particular subject, you know, I'll always save it, and it will always, you know, yes. It will always be parked if it's not even used. There's always a thing of kind of coming back to stuff.
I feel like this year I'm sifting efficiently for the first time. I've done loads of writing that hasn't amounted to much. And then now that I've got some writing that has amounted to a bit much, I do a bit more, I'm able to look back and go, oh, actually, on those four... I remember sitting there going, this is going nowhere. But in fact, that little... Yeah. That might be a joke, you know. That
I found, weirdly, Twitter... And I don't tweet tons. I think I tweet... Well, maybe if there's a show on, I tweet more. But, like, usually I'll try and, like, do, like, a joke a day or something like something like that. And I've realised, actually, it's quite a good catalogue of just sort of silly ideas. Because inevitably, they're just nonsense or something silly. Or it's something I've just suddenly thought of, and I'll tweet it. And actually, I found that's actually quite a useful thing for going through like old tweets and just sort of seeing what I was finding funny or what if there's a kind of a kernel of an idea in that. I found that useful sometimes.
Yes, I feel like a couple of times I thought, like, I'll be like, I have a big problem with memory, kind of going, sitting down from cold going, oh, what's been going on in my life? I was like, oh, I don't really know what's going on. It's just something as stupid as looking back at my Facebook feed. If it was worth me saying something about it at the time, you know, if I was worrying about whether or not I should buy a coffee pod machine, do you know what I mean? Then, and then 60 people went, don't do it, you know, various hippie friends had a go at me.
But I don't know, I don't know about you, but there's that, for me, like, if there's a truth, even if it's a tiny, tiny grain of truth in something, and it sort of then stems into something else. Like, I find that really useful to know that there's a kind of just a like a bedrock of just sort of something that I can sort of like latch onto. I find that useful just to then write, to then kind of write from. You know, so whether it's a character kind of that I kind of think, oh, it's sort of based on this person, even if I don't know them, even if it's based on someone on a reality TV show or just sort of something, and it's never referenced, but it's just sort of a trait or something like that. If there's something that I can sort of, kind of is a bit more kind of tangible in my head, I can then sort of write usually a bit better than writing, I suppose, completely cold, so that's a bit misleading.
Let's talk about some of the other projects that you've been doing, because I know that you're, well, kind of in order, I know you had Cordelia was another character of yours. Mm-hmm. Is she continuing? Was she a sort of stepping stone along the way?
I've just put in. I'm basically kind of in the process of kind of pitching a multi-character, like a slightly long form multi-charactery thing. And she is one of those characters.
And would Mr. Swallow be one of those characters? Well, are you saving?
No, I think I'm saving him because I just don't know what to do with him yet.
Okay,
because of the nature of trying to kind of get that manicness across on telly. Like, it's fine in a live environment. I think there's the charm kind of maybe just about kind of works there, but I think there's a danger it could just become very irritating. And I don't know, there's part of me that's worried a little bit that maybe the wave is changing. You know, these things, the kind of shows that they commission and the kinds of things that I think do well kind of slightly come in waves. Like, you know, at the moment you can't get a sketch show out because sort of sketch shows commission's like, no sketch shows at the moment, but that'll come around again, you know. Of course it will.
Okay.
And I sort of
and
feel,
is that where are you're divining that information just from pitching stuff and having it turned down or hearing what other people?
No, because I don't pitch that much actually at all. In fact, this is the first thing I've pitched in years. I mean, apart from the project with Julia, but, like, you know, that was a joint thing. So but I haven't pitched a solo thing since 2011-12. So partly because I sort of just want to wait till the idea's right. But the thing I was saying with Mrs. Swallow is that, you know, Mrs. Brown's Boys and Miranda, like, regardless of people's opinions on those shows, I think that there's clearly an appetite for them. Yes. But I do wonder whether that... And, you know, there's the argument that Mr. Swallow could maybe sort of adhere to the same kind of quite big character in the studio kind of environment, looks to camera or stuff to camera and audiences and all that kind of stuff. And whether... But I do wonder whether the wave is now turning. So actually, if I did try and go in with that kind of show, a kind of Some Others Do Have Them, but with Mr. Swallow, then actually people are like, no, you've definitely missed the boat on that.
Yes, you've got to catch it at the right time.
I think you've got to
catch
it
too early. You're too visionary and it's not the right time.
Yeah, and you're very lucky to get the commission.
As soon as something, you know, go, I'm going to do something about zombies. No, you can't do that anymore.
And then obviously there was the thing about mockumentary. It was all mockumentary, you know, following The Office, and then it's all kind of apocalypse-y things at the moment. Mm. And like, so it's kind of, so it's just about, and, you know, I don't want to shoehorn my characters just into any old thing. So I am pitching a multi-character thing or piecing it together separate to Swallow, who I think could have his own show. You know, I think there's an idea for his own show somewhere. But yeah, Cordelia is part of the kind of multi-character universe. And it's less, I sort of see it as a bit more, it's less fully formed as well than someone like Swallow. And like deliberately so, like it's a very obvious kind of character. I mean, it's quite a stock character to do the kind of slightly raw kind of, posh, Harry Enfield's in a posh kind of student-y character, you know, tons of people have. I mean, Jermaine, the Chris Lilly character is, a close bedfellow in that respect, as in mine's close to his, not the other way around, not suggesting for a second anything nasty. But so for me, that could sit more within a kind of still kind of nuanced but kind of character sketch world, as opposed to I wouldn't think I want to give her own sitcom.
I see what you mean.
Like, I just sort of think because I've got things to say which I sort of think are newish, but they're only newish because I'll have a certain maybe different kind of tonal approach to it or something. Like, I'm not really going to discover anything new about the kind of rich student who kind of goes to somewhere like Durham University and who wears a pashmina. You know, the kind of the broad brushstroke joke is done. I could sort of add to it, I'm sure, bits and pieces, but it's not like a groundbreaking idea.
And do you need, does that form part of the process? When you're coming up with a character, do you ever find yourself going, well, maybe this has been covered? And if you do think, do you then have to change it or back away from it?
No, not the early set, not like a creation. Because if I find something funny or I feel I've got like a voice, in inverted commas, for something, and again, it's usually based on a truth, you know, it's like... I won't stop at that stage, but I would consider whether to take that, sort of develop it into a pitch document or write a full 30-minute sitcom script, because then I sort of think, well, you know, what do I have? I mean, and it could be that I would maybe write something and think, oh, I definitely don't have something, or I definitely do, and then maybe I would explore it further. But for the time being, those kinds of characters, some of the more minor characters I've done in Edinburgh and on radio, I sort of would rather kind of pack them into a multi-character thing, because it's slightly easier. And it still has narrative and it's still long form than a character sketch show. It's not like 3 minutes, kind of a 3 minute a sketch again and again and again. For me, like Swallow feels like a separate thing to those kinds of characters, I think.
So the two more quick things to talk about before we wrap up. Your show with Julia Davis. Tell me where that is at the moment. You were chatting to Nick earlier on, and let's reprise that, because I'm fascinated by what a fixed rig means.
A fixed rig. Well, at the moment, we are on target for, I think we start production in September. So Julia's doing Hunderby at the moment. So I'm doing a lot of the writing.
This is Morning Has Broken.
Morning Has Broken, which is so we shot a pilot last year. So it's kind of behind the scenes of morning television. Julia plays a kind of Queen of the Nation type, sort of, you know, Lorraine Kelly type, not Lorraine Kelly, but a Lorraine Kelly type sort of daytime TV presenter who appears very nice on the face, very kind of motherly, but actually behind the scenes is very kind of, you know, nasty and quite cruel, and has lots of a crumbling relationship and all these kinds of things that people don't know about her, but it's all starting to fall apart. She's kind of having a midlife crisis. And I play Mike, who's sort of like the co-presenter, who is sort of starts off as kind of like the medical segment man who's on the show maybe twice a week, but then kind of gets more and more airtime and sort of starts to tread on her toes a bit. And they are friends and they sort of start to fall out, but they've got to kind of maintain a on-screen relationship and stuff. So it's, it's obviously been phenomenal getting to work with her, because I'm a big, big fan, obviously.
Sure. Absolutely, yeah.
It's just been really fun. I mean, it's been a long process. We kind of started off by improvising stuff.
Did you contact her? I'd
improvised with her and Mark Wootton for a thing where Mark, I think, had contacted me. And this was like 3 years ago. And so I met her through that. And then she got in contact and said, oh, we should develop something together. And then it kind of went quiet, because I think she went on to Hunderby. Their Hunderby had got commissioned. And so that sort of took out, I think, a year. And I remember like thinking, oh, I don't think I could ever kind of contact her and say, so what are we going to do this? but then I remember she got in contact again. And I was like, oh, geez, I think, you know, we could do this. And then we made it last summer, and we got the commission in November, I think it was.
And what's that process like of writing with her? You're in the room with her writing together, or
We improvise it all. We improvise. So we often multi-character occasionally to just get. We weren't multi-character in the show, and we don't in the show. But So to kind of get a lot of the kind of jokes, so we kind of had a loose sort of story outline, and we would then think of what those scenes are, and then we would improvise those scenes, and then they would transcribe. Someone had a huge job transcribing.
Oh wow!
I know. And then we would then
great to have someone do that for you. You just play, and then someone turns the script.
I know, it's nuts, really. And then we would edit on paper, and then kind of rewrite. So it was kind of. And then to be honest, then a lot on the day we would then improvise even further. So it's, and then edit in the editing suite. So there's lots of stages, but it kind of creates a kind of hopefully quite fresh kind of performance. And yeah, it's been really fun. So yeah, for the series, we're just sort of doing that time six, and there's a big arc and stuff. But yeah, it's exciting.
That's great. And who's it? What channel is it?
Channel 4.
Okay,
Channel 4, 6.5 hours for Channel 4.
And so, what does a fixed rig mean?
So we're just thinking of different ways of filming it. And I think what we're gonna do is, from what I've heard from the producers, is that we're doing a thing fixed rig. So programs like Educating Yorkshire and Magaluf Weekender, I suppose. I'm ashamed to admit that I watch, but it's good for character.
Yeah,
is where they kind of fix, and it all looks a bit CCTV. At the moment, but the technology is kind of so great now that you can actually get really, really good cameras, which you can sort of fix. And so we're going to purpose-build sets and then rig cameras in lots of... So that basically, if we do improvise and it leads us to certain areas, everything is captured. So you're never thinking, oh, well, that's not lit, or we can't actually get around there with cameras, or you're crossing the line. And that,
so you could just go in and run around and play.
Yeah, basically. And it means that we can also allow, if we suddenly think, oh, well, that could actually be a really good story idea, it means that we can then improvise something and then carry on the story in a different room. And everything is all kind of done. So it just kind of saves time a little bit and means that we can just sort of have fun.
And
so
you mentioned being in the editing suite.
Yeah.
And now I know that you, from seeing the Ready Steady Cook clip, it's available on YouTube.
Jeez, yeah, yeah.
So how good are you at editing? Are you in a sort of UCK position where you can make decisions about that?
Technically, no. I mean, I think I've probably got a reasonable eye for just knowing... But I'm sure anyone has, really, with any kind of comic sort of sensibilities, that, you know, in terms of leaving a certain amount of air at certain points or beats to kind of get the best out of a joke and stuff. But no, I mean, we very much would sit in the editing suite together with the editor. And the editor was the guy, Gary Donner, who did like Thick of It and Veep and stuff. And so he was very much into kind of a quicker version. And we would slow it right down. So it's kind of somewhere between the two. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that you kind of learn progressively. I mean, I wouldn't say that I'm good at it at all. I could do a little thing on a Mac and make that maybe look all right. But when it comes to kind of properly constructed narrative, I don't know if I'm that good. It's more that I could probably tell where something's not right, rather than I know how to fix it, which is probably the most annoying thing to say to an editor.
Yeah, well, I think I could see how that would be useful. Yeah. And you're in a movie as well. Yeah. It's about your movie. I'm afraid my research fails with this, but I remember seeing your chalk.
I'm in Ridley Scott's name drop. Ridley Scott's new movie, The Martian, which is out, I think, at Christmas, I believe.
And you're a sort of Houston ground control.
Yeah, I'm kind of the head of communications at NASA. Just that little job there. I mean, it was just bonkers. As in, like, it's just a rogue casting that happened to work out. I mean, it, you know, no one, at least for me, expected
that. Did they come to you? How was it?
Well, weirdly, the casting director did come and see Mr. Swallow the Musical, and then I got the part sort of off the back of that, in that she kind of became...
You need a roller skating control guy.
Well, that's the thing. It is just this, you know, straight American part. I mean, it's slightly kind of dry sense-y, but I mean, it's not a comedy, it's a sci-fi thriller. So it's kind of very different from Mr. Swallow. But yeah, it was just after Edinburgh Light, I got sort of asked to kind of come in, and then...
Did you have one of those meetings where you don't read, you just chat and you...
No, it was kind of... No, they sent me the side, but it was very much that kind of secret thing where it's like watermarked sides and, you know, even I think my agent wasn't sent the script and stuff like that. They were very kind of cloak and dagger about it. And then, I get probably two of those castings a year where it's for like a quite something that I've heard of, or a big name or something like that, and I always sort of think, you know, we won't amount to anything, but good for experience, always good to kind of do those things. And I'd had American accent lessons as well, so I just sort of thought, as in, I just wanted to kind of learn it sort of correctly, because I thought I could do one, and it turned out I couldn't. And so I thought, oh, I'll go for lessons. And it all kind of coincided. So I sort of thought, oh, well, it'll be a good opportunity to just try that out, because I'd never auditioned in an American accent before. And so, and then I got recalled for it. And then they do this kind of slightly weird thing where there's like an etiquette thing where you have to kind of accept the part before you've been offered it. So then I got a call, like a really kind of cryptic call about my availability again. And then my agent said, now, just let you know, you're going to be presented, because he wasn't there. He wasn't over in the UK. He was in the States still. And you're going to be presented to him like on tape. But if, and this is like the recall tape. And they were like, if he says yes, then you have to do it. It's weird. It's like the Queen.
We're not going to present it unless you've said yes.
Yeah, exactly.
I got you. Okay.
Yeah. Which is maybe fair enough. Maybe. Yes, but it's just that thing of like, so I had to say, yes, I will do it. Before I even got it. And so I was then really hopeful that, because I would usually not think about casting in that way. I would usually not want to think I got it, but then I had to go through this kind of thing where I had to sort of earmark the dates and say, yes, I'll do it. Yeah. But you know, yeah, it's nuts. And then I went out. So I was filming in Budapest. It was just surreal. I mean, because everything's just bigger, like as in
who's the star, who's the lead of the Martians? Matt Damon,
and yeah, I mean, it's a pretty starry cast. In I mean, because it's a Ridley Scott film. I mean,
have you read the book?
Yeah,
it is
yeah.
a much loved book. Oh, people are yeah. really excited about.
Oh man,
it.
I hope the film does all right.
If it does all right, presumably somewhere in the
I think
world,
it will.
Thinking...
I think it will, because the book's so good, and if this and the script is very true. You know, the screenplay is really true. In fact, he might have even co-written the screenplay. So I think, or he's at least like associated with it in some way. So I think that, you know, Ridley Scott, visionary. So if visually it's correct, which obviously it will be. And I can see Matt Damon doing that part, you know. I don't know. It was surreal, really.
So if this was 5 years from now, it's a hop, skip and a jump to Hollywood, and you're in demand for movies, what would be your what would be your project that you'd want to make if people were coming and saying, we've got a Nick Mohammed vehicle here?
Oh, really? I would want to play a villain, definitely.
Would you?
Oh, God, yeah.
Bond villain?
Oh, no, not so. No, no. In Harry Potter or something.
Oh, nice.
those kind of... childhood adventure kind of things I really
Wizard
like.
Wizard of Oz. I can see you behind an organ.
Yeah. Something, creepy. Like, you know, Alan Rickman's part in Harry Potter. I mean, geez, you know.
Yeah.
All those kind of, like, where, you know, you clearly know that they've just been like, we know who's going to deliver on this character. I'd love that. Yeah. But then I don't know, because maybe it'd be a bit against type. I've never been offered baddie parts in anything. So I don't know. But yeah. I'd love to do... I mean, it did make me think, oh, geez, I'd love to do another thing like this. Just because, I mean, I was like, especially because I come from like a science background, like all the science of it, and I'd loved the book anyway.
Yes.
So I loved all... And I'd done an Edinburgh show about the moon only a few years
ago. Of course, yes.
So I love all that kind of stuff. So
doing an Edinburgh show about the moon, that's almost like the turning up to the Wild West audition wearing a cowboy hat.
Yeah, geez, I mean, yeah.
I did mention it.
But when I was there, I just wanted to kind of play with everything, you know. So it was very fun. It was really fun. But yeah, it's IMAX 3D in December.
Oh my God! Yeah. I can't wait. Yeah. I can't wait.
So he always had 3D. He always had 3D glasses on, and he's 77.
Okay.
So you know, no spring chicken. But he was on it. He was on it, and I had. It was completely bonkers. But I did like it. I did like it.
Did you find the next time you walked into a... When did you shoot this last year?
November, December, actually.
November, December. So have you yet walked into like a, you know, a London Studios soundstage and gone, oh, it's a bit small?
No, because very much my stock in trade is doing little gigs at like the Dots. And, you know, I mean, it's good to kind of experience those different things. But I mean, it is a different world in the... And I'm not necessarily saying it's a better one, but it's different. And there's... You know, there's so many more people than, you know, because if you work on a sitcom, you know, the costume department is like one person, two people maximum. And then this is just like teams of kind of people, like sub-departments. So it becomes quite impersonal, actually. So I presume, unless you're a big star where you could maybe just bring people with you, like an entourage, or you're kind of maybe treated slightly differently or something like that. Other than that, it was a big impersonal experience because I was in a foreign country. I kind of
flown in,
literally flown in, picked up, given a phone, like you're just given a phone and a script, and I arrived. It's quiet, and it's like we'll text you, and
leave your phone on.
Yeah, no one really. No, yeah, well, kind of. It's like, well, they did want to fly. I remember because I was about to get married. I was getting married like a few weeks after, and we had like an appointment that we kind of couldn't change. Because it would have, like, you know, it just would have impacted on stuff. And they were like, no, we've got to fly you out today. And they weren't meant to. And I wasn't even contracted to be flown out. But they're like, no, we've got to fly you out now. And they, like, phoned in the morning, like, we've got to fly you out now. I was like, I mean, I just can't. And they actually had to reshoot that scene.
Oh, my God. Yeah. With no you in it.
But then they reshot it at the end. They did shoot it without me in it because they were like, we could maybe get away with you not being in it. Because they didn't speak in it. It was actually the final, one of the final scenes at the very climax of the film. I won't give anything away.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
but the climax of the film, when maybe or maybe not, this astronaut who's stranded on Mars is rescued and you don't know which way it's going to go. It's the big kind of tense scene in Mission Control and everyone is kind of like looking at their monitors and I'm kind of on the head thing and I'm typing away. And they wanted to do that big kind of like sweeping shot. And they just did it in real time. It was really weird. They just said, okay, we're just going to run for like 20 minutes and we're just going to shout to you when key moments happen, which you can hear is happening with the spacecraft that's trying to get him and all these kinds of things. And you have to look kind of tense all the way through. And I remember finding that quite funny because I was like, is my tense face going to be too much?
Battling like, your comic instincts.
Well, it was a bit because I was like, is it just funny that we're all like looking like, oh, how's this going to play out for 20 minutes? But yeah, they shot me out of it. And then they were like, oh, no, we're going to have to shoot again with you. So then they shot me in it. But it was fine. And he actually, that was my last scene that I then did. And then I went home. And so, yeah.
Give us your phone back. Get on the plane.
It was, honestly, yeah. But it was fun.
Finally, I'm in the habit of asking my guests, what would be your final message to comedy? Like to new comics?
Oh,
a lot of new comics listen to this. There'll be people who are sketch comics or wannabe sketch comics and I know that there's more now, but there certainly aren't the opportunities, the nights necessarily that there would be for a stand-up.
Yes, yeah.
What would be your advice to someone starting out in character comedy?
All I would say is, I mean, you'll have tons of people who've said this, is just probably gig. Just gig as much as you can. And it is difficult to kind of get on nights and stuff, but if there's any way that you can put on your own night, and even if you pack it out with friends and do it once a month, or, you know, I'm not as much as that even, but like the good thing I felt about when I was at Cambridge was that the Footlights did these things called Smokers, which are just sort of fortnightly kind of review shows, and it was just an hour, and everyone who was in Footlights could just sort of take part. I think you had to audition in front of the committee, but most people got on, and it was like an hour and a half show of everyone just doing 3 minutes, and they were every 2 weeks in term, and it just kind of forced you to just write a new skit kind of every 2 weeks. I mean, you know, we're students, so it's kind of easier, but you know, to sort of find the time and do that kind of thing. And there was obviously an audience for it and there was a theatre and stuff. But if there's any way that you can just kind of commit to kind of just writing as much, I think if you're just starting out, I know that for me, only really now do I feel I've kind of found, say, Mr. Swallow's voice. And that's taken, you know, that's taken 10 years of kind of sort of gigging and sort of reshaping. And, the essence of the character was always, I think, there from the start. Nothing's really kind of changed about him in that kind of way. But just kind of, I think, learning to become confident in your instincts of what you would cut and what you wouldn't and how you would develop something, I think can't be taught. I don't think it can be taught. You can probably read lots of good things and listen to lots of good advice. But you have to just kind of do it. And it's such a kind of psychological barrier, I think, writing something and then just trying it out and then sort of guessing based on reactions or based on whether you like it or your friends like it, but trying to make as informed decisions as you can in the early stages and kind of honing your kind of craft. And I think the only way to really kind of develop your voice and also for you to then know that you really want to do it, because it just takes so long. And to feel that you've got something original to say, to add to the kind of comedy world. I think that's what I kind of switch off at a little bit. If I feel something's just a bit flat because I feel either it's kind of been done before or that it doesn't really feel as if it's saying much new, I'm not saying by any standards that Mr. Swallow is saying some big message or anything like that, but just finding just a fun way of kind of presenting whatever it is you want to say that kind of just feels unique to you or something like that. You know, I feel that always takes a lot of time. And I think that the only way to be able to do that is just through writing and gigging. But where these gigs are, it is tough because it's quite saturated, I think, in terms of, but you know, I suppose if there's any way of setting up your own night, even if it's kind of in the back room of the pub or, you know, anything like that, you know, some of the best stuff kind of is sort of forged in those kinds of environments, I think. And yeah, is that original? Is that an original thing to say? Probably not. Is that what everyone says?
I'm just going to leave you hanging to do the music.
So that was Nick. Thank you to him for coming along. Thank you very much, as ever, to my co-producer, Nathan Wood, who's doing sterling work on all of our behalves. And also, remember, you can follow at Nick Mohammed on Twitter. He's very funny. He's got a very distinct Twitter voice. So you can do that. You can follow me at ComComPod or email me info@comedianscomedian.com if you would like to suggest a guest or ask me any questions, suggest questions you would like me to ask for any of my forthcoming guests, or of course, if you would just like to tell me that you're one of the 15 or whoever the group are. I don't know what the number is. I think it's roughly 15 in my head. If you're someone who has started as a direct result of this podcast, I would love to be able to keep tabs on you and watch you gradually make your way towards playing the O2 and booking me as your support act. So feel free to get in touch. And anything else, donate at comedianscomedian.com. We know that by now. Many of you are. Someone reminded me recently of the system I used. Remember, because I know a lot of you drive or run or bathe whilst listening to this show. If you're not in a position to donate any money. So remember, any key, I think, what did we use? The indent key, the arrow pointing from left to right at a little wall that's on the left of your keyboard. Next time you're about to press the indent key, just think to yourself, Oh, I must remember to push some cash in the direction of an arrow towards the wall of the Comedian's Comedian. That's terrible. I should have thought of one of these in advance. It was rubbish. Sorry. But when you see the indent key, send your money to me. I'll work on a better rhyme as well. That's all of that. And finally, of course, if you do want to press some hashtag dirty cash into my hand, then just make sure you either don't speak at all or say something cool. Current leaderboard is buy yourself an ice cream. Feel free to be creative in your own way. And I look forward to receiving those from you. Thanks for listening. Back next week with... Now, what order should we do this in? Because I had Ian Stone round to the... I mean, it's the flat, isn't it? Obviously, like Marin, it'd be great to call it the cat ranch or something like that. At the moment, it's the bland kitchen. I had Ian Stone round yesterday, and that was a scorching episode. That one, I think, will be next week's, and then we'll hear from Mitch and then Mark Watson after that. Thanks for listening. Speak to you soon.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.